archives. And for 3 years now, we have been collaborating together to present some of the talks here in the Heritage Lecture Series. The Lincoln panel, for instance, the speaker we had on Frederick Douglass last year, this year, the biographer of Lincoln Allen. And he will be speaking, though, about the effect that words can have in stimulating political action, particularly in causing a revolution. That will be on Tuesday at 3:30 here in the Hall of Christ. And then on the following Friday, we will have Ed Evans and Fire Chief Rosemary Rappel do a presentation on the Great Colonnade Fire of 1961, this being the 50th anniversary of that fire. This presentation in a different form was given at the Fire Hall in February on a terrible winter's day, and we had, I would say probably 1,000, or close to 1,000 people come from around the county and from Pennsylvania as well to see it. They did two presentations. It was very popular. That's what we're going to be showing them on that Friday. I also want to mention the fact that last night we had a reception for Rita Auerbach, who has given us several of her paintings and sketches from the trip to Riga, which was 25 years ago. We have lots of anniversaries this year. 25 years Catholic community, which we celebrated on Sunday. 25 years trip to Riga, 50 years for the Colonnade Fire, 100 years for the Miller Bell Tower, 200 years for Chautauqua County, and in between there, 75 years for the I Hate War speech, and the year that we were able to get out of debt in 1936. But at any rate, we had a reception last night, and her work is hanging in Hultquist Hall. However, you can't go in when there's a class, but when the classes aren't on, the doors should be open, particularly on Monday and Wednesday after the classes are through, and I invite you to go look at that. She has donated those works of art to the archives here, and we're very grateful for her. We also have her sketchbook on display in the reading room, and this is in response to all the people. Was anybody there last night? Okay, so all the people who were then telling me, it's a shame that these works of art are going to the archives and will never, ever be seen again. Well, we have them actually. We have a sketchbook on display for the rest of the summer in the reading room. So I invite you to come and look at that. And whenever you have a chance, you know the archives is located at the South Gate. Well, today we have a very good presentation for you. You may recall last year, Professor Joan Brown was here to speak about Herod's Temple. It was an excellent presentation, and the audience was very enthusiastic. So even before she left the lectern, I invited her to return this summer, and she fortunately has agreed to do so. This year, she's taking it closer, well, right now to the present, looking at how the idea of Jerusalem and the Holy Land has been reinterpreted in a more commercial sense, specifically looking at Orlando. I know this is going to be an excellent presentation. I think you made a wise choice in coming here this afternoon. Please welcome our speaker, Professor Joan Branham, Professor of Art History from Providence College.
Thank you and good afternoon. I want to thank John Schmitz and also Shira Babcock for the invitation to come here a second time. There is no place like Chautauqua. It is the most unique place, and I'm just thrilled to be here with my family. As John said, last year I talked about what my specialty is, sacred space, theories of sacred space in first century Jerusalem, and we looked at the archaeology of the ancient temple in Jerusalem. Today, I would like to specifically look at recreations of that ancient first century Jerusalem, but in modern landscapes, and specifically a very controversial recreation in the Holy Land Experience theme park in Orlando, Florida. But before we turn to Florida, I think mentioning that there has been a long history of Jerusalem recreations in art, architecture, model making, pilgrimage sites that predate the modern world. Indeed, ancient Jerusalem and its most prominent icon, the Jewish temple, have captured the religious, scholarly, and popular imagination from antiquity to today. The temple stands as a symbol of sacred space and has been a perennial source of inspiration for religious traditions wishing to create some sort of sacrality in their own building designs. Indexing the fascination with Jerusalem and the temple have been a spate of three-dimensional models, architectural models. For example, here we're looking at the first century Jerusalem model located now in the Israel Museum. It measures over 2,000 square meters, and it was designed in the 1960s by Hebrew University archaeologist Michael Abiona. Here, ancient Jerusalem, constructed within the environs of modern Jerusalem, serves as a microscopic self-referent to its macroscopic and politically fraught context. Lee Grittmeyer's temple models have toured the United States from Pope John Paul II's Cultural Center in D.C. to their now permanent exhibition space at Yeshiva University in New York. And still undergoing various revisions is the 1983 Herodian model by Alec Girard, a farmer and Methodist lay preacher in Norfolk, England. This structure was built in the barn of Girard's moat farm, and he tells us that it comprises thousands of individual clay bricks, all handmade and baked with love in the family oven. These three-dimensional reconstructions, of course, have their historical precedence in ancient artistic practices. Frescoes from the 3rd century Dura Europa Synagogue, for example, reveal a fusion of Jerusalem temple space and synagogue space. And when we're looking here, this is the Torah shrine from that 3rd century synagogue, and you can see here is where the Torah scrolls would have been kept, and right above them, a depiction of the facade of the Jerusalem temple. So we have these two links. On the one hand here, the temple image within a synagogue setting, it calls to mind the sacrality of the temple, memorializing that Jewish architectural ancestor. But at another level, the temple really kind of loads the visual dice, as it were, evoking the temple's sacred presence in the synagogue itself and imparting some residual sacrality to that space. Representations of Jerusalem in the temple abound in Christian art as well. And here we're looking at a 6th century mosaic not too far from Jerusalem in Mount Nebo, Jordan. And you can see that this is the altar area. Here are the legs of the altar from this chapel. And entering this space, you can see a depiction with a Greek translation of the Book of Psalms saying, "And they shall lay calves on the altar." And here, this picture where the animals come together is an outline of a temple complex with an inner holy of holies with a giant burning altar out front. And it's interesting here that this appears in a Christian context within the sacred confines of the apse right in front of the altar. So in fact, this sort of acts as a visual and theological platform on which the priests would then negotiate the new symbolic sacrifice of Christianity. Italy's Sacro Monte from the pre-modern world stands out as a grandiose evocation of ancient Jerusalem, and it was built between the 15th and 19th centuries. Here, a series of 45 chapels, populated by more than 800 life-size statues in wood and terracotta, recreate Jerusalem and biblical stories from Abraham's visit by the three angels to Jesus' Last Supper. By the way, who knew that Jesus had lobster at the Last Supper? Like many other recreations of Jerusalem, Sacro Monte was intended to conjure up ancient Jerusalem and its stories for European pilgrims who could not make their way to Jerusalem. America has its own history of Holy Land recreations. such as Jerusalem and the Louisiana Purchase Exposition in St. Louis in 1904. This is a two-scale reproduction of Jerusalem that included 20 reconstructed streets, holy places from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and over 1,000 inhabitants of Jerusalem who were shipped in on steamboats to participate in this exhibition. Unlike other Jerusalem reconstructions that focused on biblical times, the St. Louis Fair emphasized contemporary Ottoman Jerusalem as it was in 1900. And of course, the co-founders of Chautauqua, John Vincent and Lewis Miller, had their own vision of replicating biblical lands 30 years before the St. Louis exhibition. Calling on the skills of W.W. White, the Palestine Park was born in Chautauqua as a teaching tool for Sunday school classes. Scaled to be a topographical replica of biblical Palestine, Palestine Park is situated along the Lake of Chautauqua, and the lake doubles as the Mediterranean Sea. So you can see here, and I'm sure you're very familiar with this representing the Dead Sea, the Sea of Galilee up here, the Jordan River in between, and then in this area, the Mediterranean Sea. And then different towns, hills, and sites are located along the way. Although no longer existing, there was also a model of Jerusalem here under a canopy. And we see at this point some rare film footage that John supplied me with of from the Chautauqua archives of Palestine Park as it was used in the early days. In this clip, Jesse Lyman Hurlbut teaches Bible history to students, believing that climbing on the terrain could figuratively transport oneself to the Holy Land and solidify the geography lesson. Ancient, medieval, and pastoral 19th century efforts to conjure Bible lands take on a new twist in the 21st century's reanimation of Jerusalem and its temple at the recently established biblical theme park, the Holy Land Experience in Orlando, Florida. Located in the tourist mecca of the world, this so-called Living Biblical History Museum deploys large-scale replicas of both the Tabernacle in the Wilderness and Herod's Temple, which you see here. And so what we have then is really from synagogue to ecclesia to fantasia, as it were, the temple again emerges as a theological construct, this time within a very interesting technological simulacrum. Ultimately, in its small world approach, condensing about 4,000 years of distinctive histories into 15 acres of fun in the sun theological entertainment, the Orlando Jerusalem Temple serves as a literal backdrop to evangelical Christianity, whose typological tactics both echo and revise those of early Christianity in an interesting effort to merge Judaism and Christianity into a harmonious entity. At the initial cost of $16 million when it opened its doors, and then there have been other additions, and I will talk about those as well, the Holy Land recreates the city of Jerusalem between the years of 1450 before the Common Era and 66 of the Common Era, and is advertised as a total sensory experience, blending sights, sounds, and tastes to transport guests 7,000 miles away and 3,000 years back in time. Dominating and defining the theme park stands a towering six-story replica of the facade of Herod's Temple, built to one-half scale of the original. iTech Production Corporations is the technological company that developed different theme parks in that area. Walt Disney Enterprises, Universal Studios, Islands of Adventure, SeaWorld, Blockbuster Entertainment, and they too designed and produced the original plan here at Holy Land Experience. Specifically, they reference Abiona's Jerusalem model, simulating white Jerusalem limestone and golden filigree on the temple's architectural surface. Like Cinderella's castle just down Interstate 4 at Disney World, the temple serves as an iconic backdrop, anchoring and orienting the visitor's experience from any vantage place in the park. So here you can see it prominently located. things in the park. The park was created and opened by Zion's Hope, a Christian ministry that specializes in proselytizing to Jews, which I will say more about later, and has recently been bought by Trinity Broadcast Network, TBN, a popular American faith-based broadcaster of religious television and media. The park's status as a not-for-profit religious organization is exempt from paying taxes to the state of Florida, as well as its controversial synthesis of Christian evangelism, public commercialism, and re-presentation of Jewish history have all sparked a number of debates. In both its original and redacted forms, the Holy Land experience draws upon the image of the temple and other elements related to biblical archaeology to simulate an invented amalgamation of Judaism and Christianity. Similar to Universal Studios across the street, the Holy Land experience promises fun for the whole family. Its brochure depicts these modern Jerusalemites wearing sunglasses to differentiate them from their ancient counterparts. Upon its opening, the park's website announced its singular purpose is to provide answers to life's most important questions. Quote, where did I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? And what is life really all about? Surely no other theme park offers this at a $35 value. The Jerusalem Gold Annual Membership at $120 offers guests the ultimate Holy Land experience, including unlimited entry, special discount on Passover Seder presentations, and free parking. Arriving at the park, a mock-up of Jerusalem's Damascus Gate, combined with elements from other historical gates in Jerusalem, greets the visitor upon leaving the car. And here, by the way, is, of course, the real Damascus Gate. The visitor also encounters Roman and Greek ruins, real date palms, olive trees, pomegranate, and acacia trees, as well as Jerusalem thorn trees, which we are told are used, or the kind used for the crown during Jesus' crucifixion. These living plants promise the visitor entering the turnstiles that authentic artifacts may wait ahead. Inside the turnstiles, visitors are greeted by the blast of a shofar, while employees, all of whom purportedly have a relationship with Jesus, walk around in Cecil B. DeMille-style robes interacting with the crowds. Some of these actors, such as the blind man from the Gospels, later end up in the Jesus Ministry show to get healed. In addition to the larger-than-life reconstructions, the park boasts the world's largest indoor model of first-century Jerusalem, where educational lessons by the park's quote-unquote biblical archaeologists take place daily. The Oasis Palms Cafe serves Holy Land fast food, the live burger, Jaffa hot dog, Centurion salad, a Samson-sized drumstick, and a land of milk and honey dessert. In the old scroll shop, Jewish and Christian gift merchandise is available, such as Jewish menorahs, ritual prayer shawls, and yarmulkes. There are action figures, including an alluring Esther, Peter and John, and Moses with a burning bush accessory, frankincense and myrrh, as well as matching Jewish and Christian mug sets, one with God's name in Hebrew, the Tetragrammaton, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, and the other with Jesus Christus in Greek. Fully integrating the symbols of the two religions are the Star of David necklaces merged with Christian crosses made from olive wood from the real Holy Land. The temple acts as the critical fulcrum of the park's layout and the literal backdrop to Christian dramas performed daily. While on the one hand, the temple acts as a historical stage set for events that took place in Jerusalem, the real backdrop being presented is the authoritative space of sacred space in the temple itself. In the actual Herodian temple, and I'm looking at one of the models here that we looked at last year, when we learned about the presence of sacrifice on this very large four-horned altar, representing the central liturgical event in ancient Judaism. Temple Auditorium is the theater of life, where visitors settle down in air conditioning to view the entire history of the world in a 20-minute video. And the temple also doubles as a site of Christian karaoke, where visitors replace Levites, mount the stage, and sing their favorite gospel tunes. Criticism has come from several sectors of the Christian community concerned about the Holy Land experience's potential to trivialize and commercialize faith. Bill Maher also featured the theme park in his movie Religalist, and here you see him talking to Jesus and Jesus' agent. But the Jewish community has been the source of the harshest criticism, taking issue with the motive of the founding president and chief executive officer of Science Hope, Marvin Rosenthal. A grandson of Orthodox Jews, Rosenthal converted to Christianity as a teenager and was ordained as a Baptist minister at the age of 33. Calling himself a Christian or Hebrew Christian, Rosenthal's unapologetic goal is to bring the gospel to Jews. The mission statement of Zion Hope tells us, and here we can see it, the purpose of Zion's Hope is a simple one, yet also bold, direct, and far-reaching. Zion's Hope seeks to graciously proclaim to the Jewish people their need for personal salvation through Jesus the Messiah. Many Jewish leaders have perceived this mission, gracious or not, as disrespectful to the integrity of the Jewish religion. And such proselytizing efforts have ignited a number of protests from local Jews, like Scott Marks, who staged a demonstration as the park opened its doors to the public in 2001. Many moderate Jewish responses echo that of Arthur Teitelbaum or the Anti-Defamation League, who invoked the First Amendment and said, yes, Science Hope, they have the right to do this, but they should be sensitive not to offend Judaism and Jews or make false comparisons between Judaism and Christianity. In addition to the temple, other Jewish landmarks appear in the Holy Land experience and serve theatrical purposes for Christian dramas, such as the Qumran Caves, site of the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the daily show Behold the Lamb, Qumran forms the backdrop for Jesus' torture and bloody walk to Calvary. With Roman centurions yelling, "Clear the path," the performance resembles a medieval passion play in its narrative and graphic qualities. In the midst of cell phones ringing, cameras clicking, video cams rolling, and tourists drinking lemonade, a blood-drenched Jesus stumbles and falls, is nailed to the cross, crucified, taken down, and found missing from the empty tomb. A woman calls out, "He is risen," which is a motif carried through the topiaries in the park's landscape architecture. Finally, the crowd glimpses a resurrected Jesus cleaned up and in white robes. Afterwards, visitors applaud and line up for a photo op, not with Mickey or Minnie, but usually with a bloody-handed, friendly centurion or pose rolling back the stone at Jesus' tomb. By the way, there's been a lot written on the choice of tomb here, because, of course, it is not the Holy Sepulchre as the tomb chosen, but that Protestant preference of the Gordon tomb that was discovered in the 1880s by General Gordon in Jerusalem. And here you can see it on the right, the actual tomb, and then the recreation of the Holy Land experience on the left. The mapping of Protestant narratives onto ancient Jewish and Christian histories, as well as the park's most explicit departure from the first century, takes place in the scriptorium. So here we have a building that really evokes Byzantine domes and ecclesiastical structures, let's say, from Ravenna and Constantinople. But as we enter, we realize that it is a building not dedicated to the rite and ritual of Eastern Christianity, but more to, again, Protestant history. So here we have John Wycliffe, for example, the courageous Bible translator. travel into an ancient rotunda with voices from ancient Egypt and the Library of Alexandria to view ancient papyri. We go to the church bindery from Constantinople to Gutenberg's 15th century print shop in Germany. And we end up on the prairie in the American Midwest, where guests learned about missionaries in the Christian tradition. The final place is a large rotunda where we see the Ten Commandments in a sort of laser show etched out again to reinforce that notion of this is about the Word of God and not the ritual. So the scriptorium, it really pursues a more logocentric historical narrative. And this stands in contradistinction to the tabernacle and the temple. Also, there are some related questions about how ethnicities and cultures are displayed. In Orlando, Christian employees engage in what Jeffrey Feldman has said in a very interesting set of cross-dressings. That is, that evangelical Protestants are suiting up as ancient Romans, as Jesus the Jew, as good Jews who convert to the messianic truth of Jesus, and as bad Jews who heckle Jesus about being the Son of God. While Jesus performs miracles in modest biblical attire, Jewish figures appear dressed in high liturgical regalia with Jewish prayer shawls, and they stand strategically on the hill of Golgotha beside the instruments of Jesus' death, signaling their association with the authorities who were ostensibly responsible for his demise. Pardon me, I have a little allergy, so I've got to take some water then. And finally, the theme of cross-dressing takes on a literal sense in the ancient festival shows when the temple is physically clothed in a red silken cross, converting the Jewish temple and its altar area to Christianity's preeminent and iconic symbol. The conversion of the Judaism's legendary building mirrors Marvin Rosenthal's own biography of conversion and reinforces the mission of Zion's Hope to proselytize modern-day Jews. Questions of ethnic and religious representation also emerge in the park's claim to represent Jerusalem up to the year 66 of the Common Era. The architecture of the streets draws, however, from later Crusader and Ottoman Jerusalem, notably missing in Orlando's 4,000-year spatial distillation is any acknowledgement of Arab or Muslim presence beyond the Arabian chicken wrap and Bedouin beef pocket at the Oasis Palm Cafe, where Arabic muzak is piped in through speakers. The Holy Land experiences abbreviated and selective version of Jerusalem's constituency may reflect a larger, abbreviated and selective theological worldview that embraces only two groups of chosen people in God's eyes, Jews and Christians. As Jeff Chandler has pointed out, even the use of the term Holy Land carries polemical implications. Holy Land was the term used most frequently in the 19th century to denote the territory of the Bible, frozen in time and removed from history. Such nomenclature disregards changing political and territorial entities that have shaped the area, manifested in a range of other signifiers, such as the Levant, Palestine, Zion, Eretz Israel, among others. Moreover, efforts at monumentalizing the Herodian temple in this recreation of Jerusalem involves more than just mere reconstruction. Its presence places the Dome of Rock, which sits on that space today, under a kind of erasure, I would argue, and brings to fruition in Orlando an evangelical and dispensationalist agenda for Jerusalem. The most problematic of all the exhibits may not be the Jerusalem Temple, but its own archetypal forerunner, the Wilderness Tabernacle. The website boasts, inside the Wilderness Tabernacle, join other guests on a remarkable high-tech multimedia exploration of Israel's ancient priesthood, which points to Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God. The show begins. land will be fulfilled, and the burnt offerings of the ancient Hebrews will someday lead to God offering the perfect lamb to die for the sins of the world. A white outline of Mary, Joseph, and baby Jesus flashed on the screen. As Bert Long has said, it is a de-Judaized construction of historical Judaism. So at this point, I thought what I would do is actually show you a promotional clip, a film clip from the Holy Land Experience, and then sort of bring it all together in some of the recent developments and a conclusion. So let's see if this works.
TBN's Holy Land Experience in Orlando, Florida. It is an amazing place where you can step back 2,000 years in time and experience the wonder of ancient Israel. See the glory of the Wilderness Tabernacle through an incredible live presentation.
The Ark of the Covenant, crafted precisely according to God's exact instructions.
Walk through the sights and sounds of a Jerusalem street market.
I learned a lot about the culture during that time and how the people really lived in early modern days.
And see the wonder of the Great Temple. Examine a stunning 45-foot model of ancient Jerusalem, with daily presentations on the history of the city.
It's amazing. I've never seen a model like this before.
And be a part of biblical history through powerful reenactments of great events, including dramas highlighting the ministry of Jesus, from his teachings and miracles to a moving action play portraying his crucifixion, burial, and resurrection. The Bible will come to life as you experience the great plan of God through time, presented by an amazing cast of actors, singers, and biblical archaeologists and scholars. In the scriptorium, you'll see the history of God's Word from ancient days to the present, as you walk through a priceless collection of manuscripts and scrolls arranged in settings representative of their times.
Welcome, my friends. You have found me at a pivotal moment. My dangerous task is nearing an end. Yes, the stories you have heard are true. I have made the first translation of the complete Latin Bible into English, the language of my own people, the language of the common man.
And additional shows and presentations highlight the glorious music and history of our faith.
What I like most, I think, is the music. The singers kind of transport you to another place in time.
The new Crystal Living Waters attraction combines water, light, and music in an incredible and inspirational presentation. In the last few months, we've totally upgraded the Smile of Child Experience area, giving children a fun place to learn about God's Word. Presence of God as you relive the most important era in the history of mankind. Experience Jesus yesterday, today, and forever at TBN's Holy Land Experience.
So I think that what that video can show us is what we have been seeing as we've been examining the park and examining the map of the park. And that is a certain mapping of Christian belief systems and symbols onto Jewish history and symbols as well. But this isn't anything new. Again, we know that ancient and early Christian church fathers pulled from ancient tabernacle iconography. But I'm wondering if there is, in fact, something a little bit different at work here. In my mind, the Holy Land Experience, it departs from earlier Christian devices to appropriate but still distinguish Judaism from Christianity, all the while asserting Christianity as its successor. But like the star of David necklaces, or for example, this tapestry hanging in the gift shop as well, the Holy Land experience is a real grafting together, a coexistence of Christian and Jewish symbols. So I think that Orlando, there's an attempt not to distinguish and affirm disparities between Judaism and Christianity, but rather to dissolve differences and define the two traditions together. In a nutshell, the originators are saying to the visitor, it's okay to accept Jesus and stay Jewish. This premise continues to define the underlying principle today with the new owners of Trinity Broadcast Network. They've made a number of changes that I want to mention at this point and then talk about their relationship to that early mission statement. So for example, they have added TV sets where they can do more broadcasts. They've also added the Jonah and the Whale exhibit that you saw. There's a lot more plastic, in fact, in the theme park since TBA took it over. And they have strategically placed a number of cardboard cutouts of the Son of God for photo ops along the park, or for example, here, another one where Jesus stands at the ATM machine inviting you to get some money for the exhibit. I think of this as giving a real new definition to Jesus and the money changers from the New Testament, as well as here's Jesus at the gift shop in the cardboard cutout, and finally Jesus cut out Jesus in the kids camp, inviting them to put their 75 cents into the machine that has the little stuffed animals. As well, there's a new Holy Communion Last Supper show. It takes place every 20 minutes. They're offering Holy Communion, and at this Last Supper, the actor, Jesus, performs the Eucharist, and here you can see people are sipping their coffee of the Last Supper Holy Communion, and then partaking of the Eucharist. So this is a new exhibit, and I'm sure that many Christian communities, or Protestant, Catholic, will have some things to say about this. And the newest thing that is happening there, I was just there a couple of weeks ago. Oh, before I get to that, there's also with TV and Stakeover, I think the old sort of authentic first century Jerusalem, that archaeological perspective that Marv Rosenthal was after, has been pretty much replaced with a much more, I think, fancier look at Jesus. So he's often seen now in robes or in sort of angelic costumes posing with the children. And the thing that is undergoing construction and will be open in October is their giant new Colosseum, which is, I think the last number was around a $7 million structure that is going to be an air-conditioned auditorium inside, and its name is the Church of All Nations. And here it's interesting because the plan for this building is to hold baptisms inside. So one associates the Colosseum or other Roman activities with the persecution of early Christians. And here, again, turning this architectural structure and that tradition on its ear to have Christian activities triumph in these structures. Concerning the mission statement from the earlier Zion Hopes mission, which once again targeted Jews, TBN has revised this, and now it says that its aim is to graciously proclaim to all people the need for the personal salvation of Jesus Christ. Yet the TBN chief of staff, Paul Crouch Jr., recently affirmed that the park still, quote, wants people educated in Torah, the wilderness tabernacle, and that the Jewish believer doesn't have to forego Judaism to be a Christian believer, close quote. The experience then in the Holy Land experience is a strange juxtaposition of Jewish and Christian landmarks, activities, traditions, histories in a complex theological landscape that merges these two religious traditions into one synthetic construct. most evident in the map. The map is, for me, very interesting, of the Holy Land experience as provided to the visitors, where we can see an unobstructed path leads us, you know, from the temple to Qumran, to Jesus' tomb, the Wilderness Tabernacle. We see this then as a path that unites all of these realities. And while medieval pilgrimage itineraries, such as this 12th century Crusader map of Jerusalem, also reconfigure geographical features to fashion a unified landscape, the Holy Land experience really levels mountains and moves rivers in its three-dimensional interactive evocation of Christianity's own Jewish hinterland. So the Orlando Pilgrim, the pilgrimage route does more than simply juxtapose these different locations, but it conflates them in a convinced landscape. And in some ways, I think the visitor then sort of experiences them without that sense of disjunction, woven and aggregated together. Pivotal in this composition area stands a reinvented and structurally converted Jerusalem temple, acting as center and axis mundi to the entire site, and manifesting once again the inescapable symbolic power that ancient Jerusalem holds to this day. So with that, I'd like to open it up to question and answer.
As far as I'm concerned, Joan, again, that is truly one of the best lectures I've heard. That was at many levels very, very interesting. I
had to help. It's so, material, so.
I'd like to thank you for not only giving us a good lecture, but for perhaps making it a little less necessary for us to actually go there.
Actually, John told me when we were setting up.
I'm a little disappointed, actually, that there hasn't been more objection raised by Christian churches towards this. But which churches have raised objections? Which churches have supported?
The ones that I read when it first opened were like Calvinists and Lutheran ministers that I read. I'm sure there are others that I just haven't tapped into. Because initially, one of the things that I didn't show was in the original version, they had Torah scrolls from Eastern Europe from World War II laminated and like spray painted on the walls of the gift shop, and it raised a huge amount of Jewish concern. It's undergone a lot of transformation, but there have been Christian organizations as well. I don't know officially if, bishop is condemned it or anything like that, but when it first opened, it was the Lutherans and Calvins were the ones that I was reading. Interestingly, though, when you go there today, they invite church groups to come and to come with their preachers, but they don't want independent pastors or whatever sort of preaching there in front of, Jesus' tomb, because honestly, they do that. When they stand there in their sort of Indiana Jones archaeology garb, they're preaching. Their preacher's preaching. It's much more that than an educational experience.
Do any Jews actually go?
That's another thing. Everybody says, what Jews are going to go there? I mean, who would go there? And actually, one of the first, there's a lot, you can go online, there's millions of people just blogging about it, either to say, this was the most meaningful communion I have ever had in my life, people saying that, to people just blogging and making fun of, they saw Jesus on his cell phone, in the back and stuff, I mean, just really funny stuff, but one of those bloggers actually wrote an article, a satirist from Orlando, Florida, very funny, and one of the first things he said, I mean, he was Jewish, and he went in, and he said, what is all the commotion about? He said, I expected to see like this hypnotizing wheels going on, like get the Jews in here, like we're gonna convert you. He's like, one, what Jews are going there? Two, they're not gonna get converted by this, you know, recreation. But Marv Rosenthal, initially, in all the interviews, specifically said, he said, if I am trying to bring the truth of the gospel to people who speak Swahili, then I have to learn Swahili. I have to learn their language. He said, I'm speaking the language of the Jews. When they come in here and they see their history reconstructed and their objects in the gift shop. So that was his notion, was speaking the language of the Jews. But I think very few Jews understood that. It's usually church groups.
Are there some questions? Yes, sir.
Do you know that in Mr. Rosenthal, how many conversions have we had so far?
The question is, do you know how many conversions have
actually happened? Well, I'll tell you that the Zion's Hope, there is one figure from the BBC that I was very surprised at, and I didn't put it in my lecture because I thought I doubted it. It was 250,000 Jews were, came into the Zion's Hope, so that it was enough to raise concern, especially around Orlando and the rabbis there, about this organization. That is a figure that I've seen published, but I don't know if it's correct or not. No, it's the organization of Zion's Hope. It's not just the Holy Land Experience. That's just.
But you're not saying they converted,
right? No, this is the BBC reported 250,000 Jews had embraced or been calculated by Zion's Hope as having converted to Christianity, not because they went to this park, but because of all the ministries in the world. By Zion's Hope. Right. One of the signs out front at the opening, and this was by, I don't know if you remember, the Anti-Defamation League of Irv Rubin, the guy who was, he ended up bombing a mosque in LA and then hanging himself. But anyway, he was there demonstrating with a big, megaphone. And one of his signs basically said, Jews for Jesus are not Jews, they're Christians, point blank. And that was his, basically, I think he was trying to articulate that this notion that this organization has that you can be Jewish and accept Jesus, or that it's okay for both, and that this whole landscape affirms the compatibility of those two is, in his mind, not possible, and in many, most Jews' mind, not possible.
My wife had a comment actually saying that they probably get more Jews if they change it from $35 to $36, because that would be double the time.
You should tell them.
Is it a popular destination like Disney World, or this is, any idea of number of people actually go there?
How popular is the destination in the area?
It is not that popular. It's not like Disney World or Universal Studios. One, it doesn't have any rides, per se, and they've tried to reach out to the younger generations a bit more. But, as I was mentioning this morning, under Marv Rosenthal, it was going into bankruptcy. It was not doing well. And when TBN took it over, they are profit-making, package it up, institution, it has now the attendance rate has risen, and I think they are doing well, and I think they are making a profit again, but I actually don't know how many visitors per day. But it's nothing like the other theme parks.
Is it designed to be a destination or designed to people who are already there for this
world? No,
are there any hotels? Is it designed to be a destination that people travel to the area to see? Or is it trying to attract people who are already in the area?
I think it's trying to do both, but it does not have any hotels. People do, in fact, fly there. Were you? Who was telling me the other day that they were sitting beside someone on a plane who, oh, Terry. He said that he was on a plane to Florida, and the lady sitting beside him with her kids were flying from Buffalo, New York to Orlando to go to the Holy Land experience. So it wasn't just like, you know, we've done Disney, what are we going to do today? Oh, let's just go check that thing out. I think people are actually going there.
Yes, ma'am.
The question is,
what are the credentials of the archaeologists and the other experts and religious leaders on the ground?
The good thing is they have them all online, so you can actually go to our staff, and it tells you who they are. So the biblical archaeologists, quote unquote, are usually ordained ministers, or they might have a master's degree in Hebrew Bible, something like that. I don't know of anyone there trained in archaeology, but they're mainly ordained ministers, and they do post their credentials online. And as a matter of fact, if you go online, they have an upcoming weekend where I think pastors get in free. It's a pastor appreciation day, and the pastors have to come with their credentials to show that they are not just somebody posing as a pastor. It's interesting that they require that when Jesus, the actor, is the one who gives out the communion.
Does TBN still have tax exempt status on this because they're a Protestant community?
Yes, they do.
Does TBN story still have?
Because it is a, this was wrapped up in Florida court systems for several years, and all of our experience won because it is considered a religious outreach church organization because they do ministry there. And so it is tax exempt. Yeah. There's been a lot of Florida inhabitants have, I mean, that honestly is one of the biggest complaints by Florida residents.
To what degree do people participate when they're visiting the grounds?
Right. Except for the karaoke, I think that they are pretty much observers. And what's interesting about that, there was a, I wrote an article for Newsweek about that because I grew up in Florida, and so I know the theme parks like the back of my hand. My father worked at Kennedy Space Center for 30 years, so I grew up in that area, and you know how to react. You know how to react during a parade at Disney World or a Shamu show at SeaWorld. In this theme park, as far as how the observer reacts or participates, it's a very gray area. For example, when Jesus, you know, is falling on the ground in front of you, splattering you with blood, and you're standing there, you know, licking your ice cream cone, watching this, it's like, how are you supposed to react? And I go there, of course, watching how everybody's reacting. And you honestly see people crying, you know, looking at Jesus being tortured. My daughter, when she was very little, you know, tucked on me and said, "Mommy, is this for real? Are you really hurting that man?" You know, because it's very violent. And then others are just sitting there like on their cell phones, you know, while it's going on. So it's interesting. I don't think people are instructed how to react or doing anything specific. But the only time they really partake in anything is, I think, like the karaoke. They're not pulled out of the audience to carry the cross.
Do they do healings?
Well, that's interesting. They haven't opened the baptismal area yet, but I think they will, and I think they will be involved. I haven't seen this happen myself, but I did see online where people went to pray with Jesus, the actor, and to tell him about their son or daughter who had a problem and that sort of thing. So I think they are reaching out to these recreated figures.
Yes.
Is the community service open to all gay couples?
Yes. It's open to everyone.
Is the community service open to all?
And it's not delivered by one of the ordained ministers. It's in fact by an actor.
It is Jesus. It is less. His name is Les Chevalier. And he is the main Jesus figure. They have a couple other Jesuses, but he's the one you want. He's the best. And he's the one who does the Last Supper. He's an actor.
Thank you, Jim. Those are
I'm not a Christian. I'm Jewish. If I were a Christian, I would be mortified without taking offense at how they show Jesus. Come on, put your money in here and cut out food. I mean, they have trivialized, in my opinion, they have trivialized Jesus as a being a carnival. Nothing religious about that.
So the comment
was, he was saying that he was not a Christian, and he felt that if he were a Christian, he'd be absolutely revolted by the way in which Christ's image has been portrayed, events in his life have been used for commercial purposes, etc. And if I could just add my voice to that, I agree entirely. I mean, to take something that we believe is the most worthy of belief and to reduce it to something that isn't worthy of belief at all is what I find more objectionable. And I'm surprised, really, that Christians have objected more to this, even the church.
And again, I began researching this and was very critical and published some articles when it was still run by Mark Rosenthal. But honestly, now it makes him look really good because TBN, they have trivialized and put these props and cardboard cutouts and the money machines. And they're unapologetic about it. That is like, we are a ministry and we make money doing it. They are not apologetic. And even the gate area when I was there a couple weeks ago, these plasticky painted statues out front, I just thought, oh, it's really getting kitschy now. You know, before it was trying to be a historical reconstruction of Jerusalem. Looked good, you know. So it is, I think, the new ownership, and it is degradation, I think, of the Christian tradition.
So, John, can I carry on the tradition and ask if you would be willing to come back again?
Sure, I'd love to.
Can we get another one out of this?
Yeah.
Good.